You're listening to TIP.
One project that was kind of interesting, I bought a four-unit apartment that had caught on fire. The fire department came in, hosed the whole thing down. When you walked in, two of the units were lived in by hoarders. And I saw these and I was like, I'm buying this thing. So I bought it for $10,000. We went through seven massive dumpsters, like just to gut this thing. And took it down to the studs.
I love that your instinct is, I'm buying this thing.
Hey, everybody. In this week's episode, we're going to change things up a bit and try something new for me. I sat down with Nick Hill and Dan Foch, who are the co-hosts of the Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast. I haven't talked too much in past episodes about my own real estate investing journey, and Nick and Dan interviewed me to discuss how I got my start in real estate, how my strategies have evolved over the years, what the pros and cons of running a fix and flip business are, how I'm transitioning from residential to commercial real estate, and what some of my biggest takeaways have been from co-hosting the Real Estate 101 podcast. I'm the founder and managing director of the Wexford Group, which is a real estate redevelopment company based in Columbus, Ohio. This was the first time I've been interviewed about my thoughts on real estate, and I had a complete blast with Nick and Dan. They did a fantastic job, and I hope you guys really enjoy this episode. And so, without further delay, let's jump into this week's episode with me, Patrick Donnelly, being interviewed by Nick Hill and Dan Foch.
You are listening to Real Estate 101 by the Investors Podcast Network, where your hosts, Robert Leonard and Patrick Donnelly, interview successful investors from various real estate investing niches to help educate you on your real estate investing journey.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Real Estate 101 podcast. I'm your host today, Patrick Donnelly, and I have with me two Canadian investors from the Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast, Nick Hill and Dan Foch. I'm really excited to have them. We're going to turn the tables actually here today, and they're going to do an interview of me, which I'm excited for. First time I've done this. So I'm going to turn it over to you gentlemen, and let's get this interview started.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. I think I can speak for both of us. We're excited to be here doing some cross-border conversations about all of our favorite things, which is real estate.
Definitely. Yeah, looking forward to it.
I guess quick introductions of myself. My name is Nick Hill, I'm a mortgage agent, real estate investor, and lucky enough to be the co-host of Canada's largest real estate and investing podcast, co-hosted with none other than Dan Foch.
Yeah, my name is Daniel Foch. I'm a real estate broker by trade, investor as well. And I guess I've sort of fallen into a bit of an analyst role in the Canadian real estate market, especially mostly because realtors are the ones with access to most of the data in the Canadian market. And so just trying to tell the story of what's happening to the real estate investment space, as well as sort of the housing economy. And this has been a popular topic in the US as well, as the housing market is a big component of inflation, a big component of the challenges that we're seeing in wealth divide. So likely to be a continuing economic conversation over the next several years.
Yeah, I love it. So, we get the honor of actually interviewing Patrick for the first time today. Honor and a privilege. And don't worry, folks, we've got some really tough questions for him. Some hard-hitting gotcha type questions. I'm just kidding, Patrick.
No softballs today.
Right, no softballs. Yeah.
I love it.
Without further ado, should we dive in here, fellas?
Yeah, let's dive in. I'm ready.
Yeah, let's do it.
Great. Okay. My first question, Patrick, let's take it all the way back to the beginning. And I mean, before you even had your first investment, what was your inspiration? Like, why real estate investing? What drew you into the industry? What experiences? Take us back there.
So my dad, I'll simply say, is my hero. And I grew up in a real estate family. He's got a super interesting story. He grew up, Irish Catholic, seven kids. He was the oldest son of seven. And, you know, they struggled. They were dirt poor. He had cousins that were always like, the father was a doctor. And I think there was always that kind of rich versus poor kind of divide. And honestly, he wanted to change that. And he was not a student. He dropped out of college, dropped out of Ohio State. I think struggled for several years, like just trying to find his niche. And he actually ended up, he had a job as a, it's kind of funny. He had a job as a jockstrap salesman, selling ACE bandages and literally selling jockstraps. So, pharmaceutical rep kind of job.
And he's fun, you know, he's funny. He's got this joke that he supported half the world with the job. You know, he was just like a funny guy. And he was making, I think, about $7,000 a year at the time. And this was like early 70s, I would say. Yeah, around 1970. And he met up with a guy in Toledo, Ohio, who was building homes. And he just met him at a party. And like they started talking. And, you know, one thing led to another. And they decided to partner and do a deal together. They did a spec home, and he ended up making more on that first house that they sold after the split. Is basically he made as much as his salary selling jock straps, right? You know, he got the fever. He knew he wanted to do something entrepreneurial, but he wasn't sure what. And, you know, he did really well on this first house. They did a few more in Toledo. At the time, my mom was a nurse, so he started this home building business, and they lived off of her salary as a nurse, and they had saved a bunch of money too, relative to, you know, 1970 terms. They had a decent amount of savings, and he started this company, and he had two kids, myself and my middle brother. So, you know, it took some balls, I would say, to like start this company with two young kids and a wife and try to make a go of it. I think his first year in as an actual business, they made about $270. Was not a great first year. So long story short, he ended up moving to Columbus, starting building just spec homes here and there, buying lots and building homes and just trying to learn the business. You know, he had learned it to some degree with this guy that he had met at this party, and his brothers, he had three younger brothers. They all saw how he was doing. They saw that he was, you know, really doing well. And over time, all three of them joined the family business. So it was called Donnelly Brothers Homes. And they just got this machine going. There are four brothers who were, you know, really tough, hardworking guys. And I would say at their peak, they were doing 100 homes a year, probably. So I just grew up in that kind of environment, you know, of just being
pretty substantial.
Yeah. They literally just got this machine going. My dad's brother, my uncle Dick is his name. He passed away a few years ago. But he had kind of like, he was the hard driver who always wanted to push and push and expand and do more. And they did offices and condominiums and all kinds of stuff. They did a community swimming pool. They were just like doing primarily single family homes and land development. And just honestly, just learning as they went along. You know, it was not like they had a playbook at all. There were no podcasts. They did not have like the benefits of what we have. There's so much information out there today that it's like ridiculous. They didn't have that advantage. You know, they literally were just kind of trying to learn as they went along and just work hard and it worked out. They got lucky in many ways, but they picked the right spot in an area of Columbus that was like having massive growth at the time and just really took off. And so, you know, as a kid, I just was very interested in business and entrepreneurial things. I had a fifth grade teacher talk about the stock market. And I just kind of fell in love with the stock market in fifth grade, started buying stocks through my dad, you know, like doing a custodial account. And better or for worse, I doubled my first investment. It was probably a bad thing to happen to a kid. And it was like $300. I turned it into $600 on my first stock investment.
That's the expectation a little high.
Yeah, it was a pretty high expectation, right? It definitely gave me this fever. And I remember just as a kid, like playing, there was this video game called Baron. And the whole idea was like, you started with $72,000 of capital and the goal was to become a millionaire. And it was, I spent hours playing this game, and you could invest in all different kinds of things, from commodities to real estate, to equities, to bonds. Like each month you would get your, like what your portfolio balance was. And it was super cool. My brother and I would do this, try to see who could become a millionaire faster. And, you know, growing up, typical like small little businesses, had, you know, mowed grass in the neighborhood. I had a chocolate chip cookie business. I'd go to auctions. And so
you got the taste, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot to be said for being surrounded by it. My dad and his brothers did a neighborhood that we all lived in the same neighborhood. So every Friday night, I remember we'd get pizza all together, and that's all they would talk about was business and what was going on. And, you know, I remember like my uncles talking about passive income at a very young age. So I had a really fortunate upbringing in many ways, and a great model, I would say. Like both my dad and my uncles were just like great models to be around. And I don't know that I realized it as at the time, but definitely looking back, like I realized how fortunate I was to just have that, have my dad as a father and my uncles around me. And, you know, every summer as I got older, I started at 14 working for the home building business, just picking up trash, sweeping houses, like literally just hard, menial labor. I loved it. Like I loved getting gritty and dirty and the smell of sawdust. And at the end of the day, you could see what you had accomplished and it was super satisfying. And yeah, I loved it. So that's a little bit of my inspiration was like just a family background in real estate and really just growing up around it and being around it from a very young age.
Love it. For me, it's interesting because I came from a real estate background as well. You know, my family's been in the business for most of my life. And, you know, maybe I did the coattails thing or the cop out thing where I kind of took the easy route, right? But it doesn't sound like you did that so much per se, where you probably had a pretty clear trajectory to get into an exceptionally large and substantial business in the real estate space and development and building of homes. Yet, you know, now you're a office investor and you sort of have a really cool trajectory of the asset classes from start to finish of how you got there. So I'd really love to hear sort of like, what were your first investments and how did you get from the trajectory of like your very first small residential investment or from even from sweeping the floors on construction sites to now investing in office buildings in, you know, major metro area?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I did have that kind of like, I could have gone into the family business and I decided at a young age not to. You know, I remember I was 16 or 17 and I remember just seeing my dad and uncles in this huge argument. I thought they were actually going to like have a fight or something. And I remember like making the conscious decision that I didn't want to like do that. You know, I didn't want anything to threaten my relationship with my dad or my brothers or uncles or anything like that. I was like, I can figure this out on my own. Maybe it was a little bit of arrogance at the time, but I just was like, I want to see what I can do on my own. And for better or worse, that's the path I took. I ended up studying finance at Miami of Ohio, right out of college, worked at an investment bank. I did a management training program at a bank and then worked at their investment bank. And honestly, like I looked around, it was basically my dream job at the time, what I thought was my dream job. And I was looking around like at the 45-year-old guys that I was supposed to aspire to and not something I wanted. This was not the environment that I wanted to be in and ended up at the time, I didn't know what else to do though. I kind of like had this one single trajectory path of like, you go to college, you work a couple years at a bank, you go get your MBA and then come and join the family business, right? When I got into this investment banking program, I had like the things you were supposed to want. But yet it was not fulfilling to me at all. It kind of like made me reevaluate everything, right? And so at the time, I really pushed back against a lot of things, like how I grew up and kind of really started into this whole exploration of like, I did a ton of reading and just like, really, I wanted to like figure out a true path for myself and my own life and not following like a predefined cookie cutter kind of life that I felt was like kind of laid out for me. So it started a path of just like doing, you know, I left this investment bank and I just ended up doing a ton of different stuff. I started a food truck. I actually like worked outside of the very investment bank that I used to work at selling food. And so it was like pretty dramatic turn of events, but I loved it. You know, like I loved the freedom of it. I loved the creativity of it. Gave me time. Like, and that's what I realized is like what I most wanted was to be wealthy in time. And so this food truck allowed me to do that. You know, I worked from like whatever 10 to 2 every day. Then I had the day to myself to like do whatever, you know, go golfing or go rock climbing or go on a bike ride or read, whatever. And so I just ended up doing a lot of different things. I rode my bike across America from California back to Ohio for a fundraiser. I was really into Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau at the time. I built like a little Henry David Thoreau cabin. I ended up leading bike trips for a company in California, like in wine country and leading really high-end bike trips in, you know, wine country in Napa Valley, Northern California, Martha's Vineyard. Ended up living a couple years in Vietnam. I tried to do a ton of adventures and I was fortunate. My dad was doing a condominium project right when I was in at this investment bank. And my first, to answer your question, Dan, was like the first investment was this condominium that I bought. I was super fortunate. He sold it to me at cost, and it was like a little two bedroom, 1400 square foot condominium. And I rented it out to this lady and her husband. And this was in 1993. I'm kind of dating myself, but this was 1993. And I still have the same lady living in this condo that I bought in 2023. So she's paid for the place. I hope she doesn't listen to this, but she's paid for the place several times over, and she's been great, taking way better care of it than I probably ever would have, and treats it like her own place. And yeah, so that was the first investment.
I imagine with rent controls, she's probably not too unhappy with the rent controls. I imagine if she's been there since 93.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, she's been a great tenant. I'm way, way below market rate, and that's fine with me. Like I'll bump her a little bit here and there, but in general, I'm just happy to have her. And, you know, it's been a great investment for me. And like I said, she's paid for it a couple times probably by now. And yeah, so, and we can get into this later, but I generally would give deals to people who are great tenants. Like, I'm happy taking a little cut in rent as long as they're going to like be great tenants, pay on time and take care of the place. That was my first investment. And
yeah, tenants are the best asset for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So I take care of her, and we've got a great relationship, and it's been good.
Yeah, I mean, we say that all the time in the podcast, right? The real estate is a relationship-based business, and essentially your clients are likely your tenants if you're a more traditional residential landlord. So really great story so far, Patrick. What I'm hearing, which I think is great for the audience to hear and understand, is that you haven't been in real estate since your early 20s or whatever. You've taken a very untraditional path. It has not been a linear journey for you, but you're still killing it right now. And I think that's something that a lot of people, whether you're in America or Canada, that need to remember is, you know, there's such a FOMO mentality. I need to get in now. You know, I'm going to miss all these good deals. They're all going to slip away. Well, no, there's deals to be found in any market. It's never too late to start. You know, you're going back to having your why, which is time, which I think is probably one of the most common reasons that people get into real estate investing, is to gain wealth, but to use that wealth to gain time. I want to keep things going and move on to the next question here. You've talked about finding your first deal, which was a great story, but I want to know how you found your second deal, your third deal, your 10th deal. How are you finding deals now? What strategies are you implementing to, you know, get your next duplex, your next fix and flip, or your next apartment building? Walk us through that.
Yeah. So the second deal happened. I was living in Vietnam. I had come back from Vietnam, and frankly, like, the reverse culture shock was really difficult. You know, I adjusted to moving to Vietnam. I was there a little over 2 years, but coming back was really tough. And I ended up doing, my youngest brother and I bought a lot and ended up doing a spec home. And again, fortunate, I was like, I'm going to take advantage of the opportunities that I have. And at the time, you know, my dad was doing a bunch of homes. We used one of his blueprints. We used his subs. It was fairly straightforward, and we did really well on it. You know, we made about $32,000 on this flip, and we split it. So it was a great little taste. It was a fun project for the two of us to do together. But then going from there, I was older at the time, and I ended up finding a little neighborhood outside of Columbus, Ohio, which is like the last neighborhood to have been fixed up. It was like a gentrifying area. It was really run down. I don't know if you guys have ever seen Hillbilly Elegy or know that book or movie, but this neighborhood is super Appalachian. So it's really rough.
Amazing. One of my favorite books, actually.
Is that right? Yeah, it's a great book. I listened to it on Audible, but
yeah, exceptional book for sure.
Yeah, I love it too. And so this little neighborhood was exactly Hillbilly Elegy, literally. And so very Appalachian type people, had probably had five or six generations of basically people that had migrated from Kentucky up to Ohio. And the neighborhood was just totally in decline. My first homes I was buying for like $10,000, $12,000, $14,000. And these were rough, but like the bones and everything were super solid. 100-year-old homes that were you know, great foundation, great, you know, when 2x4s were really 2x4s, like really great framing. And so I just identified this little neighborhood and decided to just focus 100% on that neighborhood and do what I could in it. And at the time, there weren't a lot of people buying down there. It was like kind of a market that was like viewed as whatever, you know, like it just was not viewed very favorably just because of the client, you know, the tenants that are down there and the type of people that are down there. And it was really rough and gritty, but I loved it. That's the place I want to be. It's literally like minutes from downtown. And so it's just a matter of time. I thought my thinking was like, it's just a matter of time before this neighborhood turns. People realize like these homes can be fixed up. And that was the strategy I decided upon. So I bought my first one. It was a short sale in 2014. And I bought it for $24,000. Did a renovation of it. You know, it was completely trashed. There was like crackheads that had been living in it. So it was rough.
Classic.
Yeah, exactly. But those are the kinds of things I like to buy. You know, like stuff that nobody else wants to touch. They walk in and they're like, ooh, you know, this is horrible. I got a buddy who's like, it smells like money. You know, it's like, it smells like money when you look into a place like that. It smells like...
No, that's urine, but...
Yeah, no, that's a cat. Yeah, right. That's what I started buying was homes like that, renovating them, getting tenants in. And it's worked out really well. Like I tried to hire local people, like whatever, the people that had lived in Franklin, it's called Franklinton, that had lived down there for years and years. A lot of them have like a ton of skills, but a lot of them also have like drug and alcohol issues and things like that. And so that was difficult. But yeah, I just was doing renovations and then doing a mix of at once the renovation was finished, doing either a rental or selling it, depending on, you know, my needs for capital.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey, everyone. It's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host. Hey guys, have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only does the research and analysis for you, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Well, wonder no more. Meet Meka, your AI-powered stock research assistant, now enhanced with real-time stock data. Let Meka do the heavy lifting for you to significantly reduce your research time. And the best part, Meka is 100% free. Ask Meka questions like, explore the financial health of Apple through a summary of its balance sheet. Compare the financial statements of Apple and Tesla. What is the analyst price target for Microsoft? What is the social sentiment analysis of Amazon? And millions of other queries right at your fingertips. Visit Meka.com. That's Meyka.com.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. All right, back to the show.
Yeah. So how did your strategy evolve over time? Like you know, it sounds like you were doing a little bit of kind of like your fix and flip, but then you'd stabilize them, rent them out. Were you kind of starting to try and take some equity out of these properties, refinance them and grow a portfolio? And did your strategy change? Like, how did it change over time? How did it evolve over time? And sort of how did it progress into what you're doing now, which is like a shift over into a different asset class and an interesting asset class to be doing heading out of the global pandemic. So I'd really like to learn about kind of how you ended up to where you are today.
So yeah, like I said, I was just buying stuff for $10,000, $12,000, $14,000, fixing them up, putting tenants in. In a lot of cases, I would do like a renovation that would be to the point where like what I would do if I were to like sell it to a first-time home buyer. It was like, this is going to be a rental. So I would do a nice renovation, but definitely not crazy on the renovation costs, with the thought that in 3 to 5 years of after renting it, basically I've gotten most of my capital back from rent in most cases. And then at that point, I would do a second renovation, which was like a really nice one with the intent to sell them. And so that's what I did in a lot of cases. One project that was kind of interesting, I bought a 4-unit apartment that had caught on fire. The fire department came in, like, you know, hosed the whole thing down. When you walked in, 2 of the units were lived in by hoarders. And I saw these and I was like, I'm buying this thing. So I bought it for $10,000. We went through 7 massive dumpsters, like just to gut this thing, and took it down to the studs.
I love that your instinct is, I'm buying this thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And, you know, again, it was like most people would like just be like, hell no, I'm not touching that thing. You know, it needed a rebuild due to the fire. But yeah, it was probably the biggest project that I had done just in terms of the amount of work. And in each case, like I view each project almost like, what can I learn from this? Like, I really just want to learn as much as I can, you know, develop as a renovator, like learn what I can, like the processes and the systems and how to get more efficient at it. And so by taking on this like really bombed out, you know, 4-unit building, I was just like, I don't know how this is going to turn out, but my basis is only $10,000. It can't go too bad, you know? So that's kind of like a TIP, the Investors Podcast. Like, you know, we're into value investing and Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger. And so that was always a thing of mine, is like having a margin of safety, buying below replacement cost. And in all cases, like, what would this building cost to build? And it sure as hell is more than $10,000. So I didn't do like a ton of I've got a finance background, but it's like back of the napkin math, honestly, nothing crazy. But yeah, I did 100% renovation on it.
Yeah, we always say, if it doesn't make sense on a napkin, it's not going to make sense in Excel.
Yeah, exactly right. And I don't think you need Excel, honestly. I mean, maybe in some cases, but for what I was doing, definitely not. And I heard you, Nick, say on one of the episodes I listened to yesterday that you need to have multiple exit strategies, like when you go into a project. And that's how I viewed things as well. Like, I was like, well, I'll renovate these things. I will try to rent them. But at the time when I was renting them, like the rent that I was asking was way higher than anything, you know, that was in the area. So that didn't work. And I was like, well, the next option was like, maybe I'll try to sell it like as a package. That didn't work. So I ended up doing a condo conversion. So I turned all 4 apartments into individual condominiums and sold off, you know, 4 different condominiums. And that worked great. Like it was super profitable. It, you know, it was really a good project and a fun project. You know, I feel really proud of like the taking a really crappy eyesore of a building and then turning it into something really nice that people want to live in and buy and that kind of thing. It's pretty rewarding.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's, you know, one of the core principles that we try to abide by as well is, you know, we're not just in real estate to get wealthy. It's actually doing something good. And, you know, going back to what you said about value investing, one of my favorite real estate quotes ever is, I don't buy real estate because I think the value is going to go up. I buy real estate because I can make the value go up. And that's from Real Estate Trent on Twitter, an amazing follow. I want to dive into the project you just finished telling us a story about. Maybe use that as a springboard to talk more about kind of fix and flips, because you had mentioned, you know, you'd like to keep more in your portfolio, but starting out, you needed capital to get to the next deal, and maybe some of them you couldn't refinance because you didn't hit the mortgage requirements or whatever it may be. Let's talk about fix and flips, because I think, you know, they've been so romanticized on HGTV and all these shows that we all watch, and everyone thinks a fix and flip is so easy. Well, you get in, you paint everything white, and you get out and, you know, you make 50, 60 grand, whatever. Fix and flips, in my opinion, can actually be a very risky investment strategy if not done correctly. So from your point of view, Patrick, a man that's done several of these successfully, what do you think some of the major pros and cons are, and what's, like, you know, the strategy around a good fix and flip? Walk us through it.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, Nick, like, it is definitely not a sexy business, you know, like shown on TV. Absolutely, it's not. It's a job, honestly. Like, it is a grind. And, you know, you got to have the mindset like, this is going to be difficult. It's not an easy thing. I mean, maybe some renovations can be easy, like if it's just, you're just putting lipstick on something, but that's not the renovations I was doing. In general, I was taking them down to the studs and doing a complete rebuild. And so, you know, that's a long, laborious, tedious process. And there's a lot that goes into it. I mean, the pros is, like you said, you can force a lot of appreciation by doing this. I was lucky I found a great neighborhood that was rapidly appreciating in value. And I was able to get in at a time where I could buy stuff. You know, the stuff I was buying for $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 is now, they're $100,000 to buy right now. Like, that neighborhood has gone nuts. And it's one of the reasons why I've transitioned out of there. Like, the numbers just started not to make sense to me. You know, it just was hard for me to get my head wrapped around the fact that there are homes that are selling for $500,000 in a crack neighborhood. You know, it's like, really hard for me to get my head wrapped around, but it's happening and people are paying for it, you know? And so the cons is, like, I would say it's the grind, and it can be risky. Like, if you don't know your numbers and you don't have a margin of safety, you can get, and you're taking on leverage, which I didn't take on a lot of leverage ever. I did do a refinance, Dan, that you asked about, and pulled some equity out of the rentals that I had to do more fix and flips. But the key factor is, like, not to get over leveraged. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that are out there right now that have gotten over leveraged, particularly if you've got an adjustable rate mortgage. Like, you're in tough shape potentially. You know, if you've you know, had an adjustable rate mortgage at 2% and now it's, like, you know, triple or whatever, you know, more than triple. That's a tough spot to be in. But yeah, it's a good business. I think for a lot of early investors, it's a great way to learn real estate. Like, you need to know the nuts and bolts of real estate, you know, from the ground up, ideally. Like, you can farm that out probably to somebody else, but personally, I wanted to really know it and know how a house is built. And so yeah. I think that's one of the advantages, is once you know how to build a house, like, you can add value to a lot of different things. It doesn't have to be residential. And that's, you know, I'm segueing to commercial right now, and it's the same kind of processes. It's just on a commercial office building.
Great explanation there.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. In regards to actually, like, so let's maybe pivot a little bit to the actual management of the asset. So, because you mentioned, you know, we kind of went through, okay, renovating, positioning of the asset, figuring out how to maximize the value, create as much value as we can. And now, you know, you're between having experience with multifamily assets, but also now making the segue into commercial assets. Where do you see the differences, but also, you know, what kind of strategies can you employ for listeners, but also what do you do yourself to manage your rental properties successfully, and what strategies do you use to attract and retain tenants? Does that sort of start with a full scope kind of marketing strategy where you're really even building the property to attract the certain type of tenant? Can you just give us a kind of rundown on your strategy there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was in this neighborhood every single day, you know, grinding it out, rebuilding these homes. And people, obviously, like, they're watching what's going on. The first one that I did was directly across the street from a church that actually had a program that they would take women that were coming out of prison, you know, and that's a tough spot to be in. You're coming out of prison, and what are your opportunities? So this church would put them through a 2-year program where they would give, you know, get them housing, make them get a job, make them go to AA or whatever if they had drug or alcohol issues, make them go to church, like, really gave them a sense of community and a sense of belonging, and gave them a second chance, right? And so I became good friends with the pastor. And after the 2-year graduation, the pastor would often kind of vet potential tenants for me. So they would have to go find their own housing after 2 years. And since I was in the neighborhood, she would often, like I said, vet women that had done really well, who would be good tenants or that she thought would be good tenants. And so in several cases, I would then rent to women that, in one case, you know, had been in prison for 20 years for murder, frankly. Like, and most people wouldn't give somebody like that a chance. This lady was amazing. Similar to my very first tenant who's lived in this condominium I own forever. Same kind of deal. Older lady, if you met her, she's like your grandma, you know, just a really sweet, kind lady who took amazing care of the place. And what I found was, like, I treated her really well with respect. And I think, like, she wasn't used to that. As a result, like, it just paid off, you know, like, she valued the opportunity to live in a very nice home and, you know, took great care of it. And I just try to, like, take good care of my tenants in general. I was below market rate a little bit, but I wasn't doing it to, like, maximize my cash flow. You know, I like cash flow, don't get me wrong, but, like, I also want to, if I can, I want to try to do some good in the world, you know, through fixing up these places and renting them to people that need a chance.
Yeah, I think we talk a lot about that on our show, which is, like, you know, real estate is very much a relationship business, and you know, managing the relationship with the tenant. Like, a lot of people want to say, oh, real estate's passive income. I mean, I don't even know if anything is passive income, like maybe Bitcoin mining or something like crazy like that, right? Dividend investing, but still, like, nothing's passive, right? So I would say, you know, it's less passive and maybe more of a side hustle. And you have to factor in that, you know, you're providing a service to a customer and the customer is a tenant in that case. And so, you know, you've really figured out how to make it probably more passive by making sure that the relationship aspect of that business is good. That's probably, like, the core principle of good property management. I would totally agree with you there. Sorry, Nick, I know I cut you off there. So jump in. I think you had another question here.
Yeah, I know we're kind of jumping all over the place here, but we've got a lot to talk about, and I want to get as much out of you as we can while we have you here, Patrick. So you have got obviously a great story. You're crushing it in real estate right now, but I want to talk about your experience with the podcast so far, because you are lucky enough to be the co-host of the Real Estate 101 podcast. Dan and I are similarly lucky guys where we get to have a podcast and put it out twice a week, but ours is really data driven. So unfortunately, Dan and I usually just talk to each other, which I'm surprised we haven't gotten sick of each other yet. You, on the other hand, are lucky enough to have guests on. And now when you know, Dan and I had another podcast before this, kind of lived in relative obscurity, but we did have guests on weekly there. And I can say that every single one of those guests that we had on has earned to a friend, a contact, someone that I can pick up the phone and they will take my call whenever. Tell us about some of the great experiences you've had with guests, obviously present company excluded, and then maybe some of the things that you're seeing that come up time and time again, right? Some things that you've heard different investors in different asset classes and the similarities in what they're saying, whether it's investing principles or just some fundamentals of real estate. Any major takeaways from there?
Yeah. So first off, I mean, it's been an amazing experience for me to get the chance to talk to guys like you, to talk to, like, reach out on real estate Twitter and invite people on the show. And I love to learn. Like, I literally just could learn all day long and listen to podcasts, read books. And so to get paid for it and interview people that are super smart, doing super interesting things, like, it's a huge blessing. I'm really thankful to TIP for the opportunity. And so it's been super cool, and I love it. I've never done a podcast prior to this, and it's, as you guys know, it's like a learning process for sure and getting comfortable with it, but it's been a lot of fun. In terms of, like, the guests that I've had on and some of the commonalities, I mean, just what comes to mind is the importance of finding your niche. I think initially, like, it's important to have a general, obviously, understanding of real estate and how things work. But in a lot of cases, the guests that I've brought on have really found their niche and honed in on that and don't deviate and don't have I get prey because of the role that I'm in interviewing a lot of different people. I'm kind of prone to the shiny object syndrome of, like, oh, self-storage is cool, or, oh, you know, Airbnb is interesting, or, you know, the different things that we all get exposed to. It's like, you can't do that. You've really got to focus and decide what your niche is going to be and drill down on that.
Shiny object syndrome. Yeah, it sounds like a very, very type A kind of ADHD personality that's exceptionally popular, I think, in the real estate space.
Yes, definitely.
very characteristic of Nick and I for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, I just think of some of the guests that I've had on. Sean Sweeney, who's really popular on real estate Twitter, got a pretty great following. He's got an awesome story. He was considering law school, decided not to go to law school, read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, like a lot of different people, and, you know, it influenced and changed his life in many ways. He decided he wanted to get into real estate and took a job as a receptionist, right? And one of the themes I see with a lot of guests is, like, early on in their careers, they're willing to do whatever it takes simply to learn, to be around great people who are doing what they want to do, and humbling themselves and saying, I'll make copies. I don't care what, you know. In his case, he told a funny story where he told a project manager that he knew Excel, and he had no clue how to do Excel, but he's like, I'll figure it out. And he went home and tried to teach himself Excel. And I think you got to have that kind of willingness to humble yourself and take the jobs just that allow you the opportunity to learn. And from that, if you're doing good work, like, it's going to get recognized. And if you've got the grit and persistence, like a lot of these different people do, you know, they end up having careers that are amazing. Now he's, like, you know, a developer in Minneapolis doing incredible projects that, you know, for me, I'm just like, I need to think bigger. It's just interesting to see what people do, you know, and he's got a very normal, regular story. And that's what I've learned, is all of these people are just regular, normal people who have just found their niche and run with it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I think, you know, to use that also and touch on this shiny object syndrome that you mentioned, is there any, like, specific trends that you're seeing in the real estate space, or, you know, that you've picked up from listening to people on the show that you want to pursue, and how do you kind of stay on top of, like, what's happening in the space data-wise, or, like, what the new opportunities are? And then kind of on top of that, like, has it really prompted you to try and pursue different asset classes? I know you mentioned a couple of other ones, Airbnb, self-storage, et cetera. Where are you at on that?
Yeah. So in terms of just kind of following trends, I would not say that I'm as data-driven as you guys are. I definitely value data, and it's super important. But I kind of have my antenna up on real estate Twitter, I would say, is, like, my primary means of just, you know, if you curate the right people, you can get an incredible real estate education on real estate Twitter alone. And I think for any young person who is trying to learn, I would start there and follow the people that Moses Kagan is a guy, Sean Sweeney, like, follow who they follow. Chris Powers is another guy. The Fort podcast is awesome. There's so many people doing amazing things and giving. They really have this, like, abundance mentality of sharing their playbook. And so the playbooks are out there. You just have to find what attracts you. And like I said, just take some steps, take some baby steps and do it. In terms of shiny object syndrome, I definitely am guilty of that. I try to stay focused. My wife and I haven't really gotten into this, but she bought an office building, and she's a mental health therapist. And she's got 23 offices, and it's kind of like Salon Lofts is a company that rents out space to hairdressers. We're doing the same kind of idea, but we're renting out space, individual offices, to mental health therapists. And so, you know, we thought that maybe when COVID hit, the pandemic hit, like, it was really going to kill the business model. What we found was, like, people want to be face to face with a therapist. I mean, this is cool what we're doing and being able to Zoom and do video calls, but for a therapist client relationship, they want to be face to face. And so she didn't really have much of a downturn at all in terms of, there was a couple people that struggled to pay rent, but she, you know, we worked with them. And so she ended up having a waiting list, basically, of people that, and I want to take a step back. She's created community. And so as a therapist, it's really hard, you know, it's very individual and solitary, and it can get lonely, right? And so she's tried to do a really good job of creating a community. She does this thing every couple weeks, called Shrink Tank. It's not Shark Tank, but like Shrink Tank, where they all get together and just, like, talk best practices or problems that they're having. Amazing. With a client. And she's done a really fantastic job of just building community with therapists, and they want to be a part of that, right? And so she's got a waiting list. We're like, we got married in September, and she, you know, we're like, let's do another one. We've got many people that would do another office. And so, just kind of on a lark, I honestly didn't think this would pan out. We found an office literally about 60 seconds from my house. in Columbus. And it's just kind of a unique, I live in an area called German Village, which all the buildings are brick. And it's, so it's like all the roads are brick. It's like really kind of a quaint little, almost European feel kind of a neighborhood. And this office building was two brick homes at one point, side by side. They connected the lot and at one point just created this entire commercial office building.
And it was run by this somewhat dubious doctor.
Did like pain management. And so he was just churning through clients like 100 a day, handing out prescriptions, basically just a pill popper kind of guy. The DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, raided him last summer, shut him down, and took his medical license away. And so, you know, this office has been sitting vacant for about a year. And so I found it on LoopNet, and a lot of people say you can't find anything good on LoopNet. I mean, I disagree with that. There are things on there. And we got lucky. I mean, this guy was in a bad spot and was forced, you know, they took his medical license away. He had to sell this office. And we put a lowball offer in and, you know, negotiated, but we ended up getting it at a really great price. And now we're in the middle of a renovation and it's a fun project. Like, it's super creative, really interesting people that want to move in as therapists. We love to work with them and figure out what they want and just create something that, you know, a place where they want to work and see their clients.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guy's trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Hey guys, the Range Rover Sport leads by example. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capability and combines assertive on-road performance with the signature Range Rover refinement that you'd expect. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, and redefines sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, which offer new levels of comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit-like driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can also enjoy a dynamic drive in total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show.
I think the work that you and your wife are doing is fascinating. And again, it really shows that you can get so creative in real estate. I want to touch on something that's come up a few times, but we haven't done a deep dive on it, and that's exit strategies. Now, going back to the original question about fix and flips, or any type of investment, to be honest, especially if you're pitching it to a JV partner or anything like that, you know, we always like to have those three good, better, best, you know, best case to worst case scenario exit strategies and have those modeled out. Now, that can be on an individual asset by asset basis, but it can also mean what is your grandiose exit strategy? As you know, are you selling the whole portfolio and moving to a beach anytime soon. I know that you are in the middle of a reverse 1031 exchange right now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, what you're trying to accomplish there, and then how has it been working with your wife? Because I know that real estate investing, Dan and I both have very patient girlfriends. So shout out Steph and Nicole, that you know, not everyone can understand the difficulties and the challenges that constantly arise in real estate investing, even when things are going really well. So tell us about the 1031, maybe your general exit strategy, and then love to hear what it's been like working with your spouse.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in terms of the strategy, so what I've been doing is taking most of my investments in Franklinton, this gentrifying neighborhood that I've been working on since 2014, and selling off, you know, piece by piece, house by house, that portfolio. And so right now I'm selling, it's kind of unique. There's two houses that I'm in the middle of selling. And so a reverse 1031 is when you buy a property first, and then the relinquished properties is what they're called. The relinquished properties are the houses that I own in this gentrifying neighborhood that I have 180 days to sell. So I'm in the middle of that. The one of the houses was in great shape when the tenant left. That was an issue. It was like, well, how do you deal with tenants? Like in terms of I'm going to sell these things. So is it better to get the tenant, leave the tenants, or get them out of there and do a renovation of them? And so I decided to get the tenants out, and which was very difficult because, again, like I developed friendship basically, and this is not a good thing in some cases, like I developed almost a friendship with them. And so to ask them to leave their home was super difficult, really hard thing to do. It worked out very fortuitously in both cases. One lady, her father died and like she inherited a home. The other lady found a little rental that was one street over. So it was amazing, kind of like it worked out well for all of us. So I asked the tenants to leave. And so I'm in the middle of renovating. It's two properties, but one of the properties has three houses on it. So it's got a main house and then like two mother-in-law suites on two lots, basically. And so basically all three of those need to get renovated, plus this fourth home. So I'm in the middle of that, which is, it's a lot, you know, where I've got till May 31st to get these sold, and we'll see how it goes. You know, I don't know if you guys have ever, you don't have 1031s, I don't think, in Canada,
no,
do you?
We don't. We're jealous.
It's unfortunate.
We don't have any of the fun stuff in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an amazing thing, you know? And so, yeah, but it puts a little pressure on, and I think it'll be fine. But yeah, I'm spending time marketing these homes and selling them. And, you know, I enjoy the selling aspect. Like I know the houses really well. I really enjoy like meeting potential buyers and showing them, like, I like that. I love the sales and marketing process, probably more so than the actual renovations, which can, like I said, can be a grind. But yeah, and so we have bought this building together. And to your point, Nick, it's challenging at times. I'm not going to lie. Like, you've got to have a really solid relationship with your partner if you're going to, with any partner. Like, you know, it's difficult. And especially, you know, if you're married or a girlfriend, whatever. In my case, we've got a great relationship. We've been together for 7 years now and, you know, just really trust each other implicitly. But we butted heads, you know, like along the way. It's like you got to kind of each have your own lane and stay in it. And so like she kind of lets me handle the renovations, and then she's really great with dealing with the therapists who are our clients and figuring out what they want and kind of like the final design touches of the offices, not of the offices because they're responsible for that, but like, you know, the waiting rooms and the bathrooms and just the art on the wall and that stuff. Like I turn that completely over to her and I'm like, have at it, you know? So we've done well in finding our respective roles, and you know, we're definitely learning as we go along, and we'd like to continue to do more of these. I think there's a definite niche, and I think there's a lot of, you know, office space has got crushed in many cases. You know, like I'm not sure what Canada's been like, but I got to imagine like same thing in the US. Office space has just really gotten hurt, and there's going to be more and more opportunities to do what we're doing, like to pick up deals at a really good price. Because in a lot of cases, like, you know, people are working from home and they're not wanting to be in an office anymore.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the US space, you guys just hit for the first time over 50% average office occupancy. So that's 50% of pre-COVID. Castle puts out a really cool index on that. We only monitor one market, which is Toronto, sort of, you know, I mean, in America, you guys would call it probably downtown Canada, but Big city by all means. I think it's bigger than Chicago now, but we're at about 42%. So lagging for sure. I think the big difference is, you know, in the US, much stronger capital market systems that where owners don't depend as much, you know, they're more capitalistic. Whereas in Canada, we have a big problem to solve because a lot of pensions own big real estate assets in Canada. And so a lot of these bigger office towers, like you're seeing some defaults happening in LA and San Francisco, you know, even notable landlords like Brookfield, one of Brookfield's funds out there has defaulted. There's a couple of other ones. I think it's going to take some time to unwind, but I would agree with you. And much the way I feel about the entire real estate scope right now is this is going to create once in a lifetime real estate investment opportunities for the millennial generation. And so that is what excites me about the whole thing. Should we maybe jump over to the rapid fire round here? Do you want to do that?
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah, I think that that would be great.
Yeah. So what's the most impactful book that you've ever read?
So I'm a huge reader. I've been reading since I was a kid, and there's so many. I mean, it kind of depends again, like on the area that you're talking about. But like in terms of real estate, there's, you know, there's so many. I hate to say Rich Dad Poor Dad, but the cash flow book that he put out was really important one for me. I think the concepts of Rich Dad Poor Dad are great. The second book was called Cash Flow, which is really good, which just gets into the concept of how you generate cash flow for yourself and create a life of, you know, more freedom and having time wealth, like we talked about earlier. You know, we are Warren Buffett guys, and I think the shareholder letters of Warren Buffett are an amazing. It's not strict, you know, certainly not real estate, but the shareholder letters of Warren Buffett are an incredible read just to have like great business understanding, like from an amazing, basically, you know, the Mozart of investing is how, you know, like what I would say. I would encourage anyone to read those. There's a book, actually a guy I'm trying to get on the show. It's called Confessions of a Real Estate Entrepreneur, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with, but it's a really good book written by this real estate attorney, lawyer, who's done a ton of different things. And, you know, he goes through just stories of different deals that he's seen and participated in. It's a great book to realize like just how vast and how creative real estate can be, you know, and I would recommend people to check that out. Yeah. So I those would be a handful. And, you know, there's obviously other ones like in fiction and, you know, personal development kind of stuff that have also had an impact, but we're going to stick to real estate here.
I don't recommend reading any books. Just listen to podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's another, I recommend that as well. And I honestly, yeah. Like I've really gotten into Audible. Like I listen to most things now. I don't do a lot of reading lately, it seems. And so, yeah, listening to podcasts, listening to Audible, it's pretty amazing. Like just to turn your car into a learning university as you drive around. Like I just don't even listen to music anymore, honestly.
Yeah, same. Love that. Okay, next quick one here. What is your best investment?
Best investment. So I'm hesitant to say this, but like I mentioned this condominium conversion that I did, and I took the proceeds from the sale of those four units and bought a bunch of Bitcoin when it was like in the $7,000, $8,000 range. And that's actually kind of how I ended up at TIP. I was a big fan of Preston Pysh, who has a show called Bitcoin Fundamentals, and, you know, got into learning about primarily Bitcoin in 2017 and went down the rabbit hole. I'm really into like sound money and understanding the monetary system. It's like a sea that we're swimming in, and nobody questions like, what is money? I think it's an important question to ask, like, what is money? What gives it value? And he was very formative in my learning. So a shout out to Preston and Bitcoin Fundamentals. But yeah, that was my best investment. I kind of went all in at a low price relatively, and wrote it up to whatever its high was, 68,000, 69,000. I've ridden it all the way back down, which is super painful. The last year has been very painful. But, you know, I continue to just kind of dollar cost average and just build my Bitcoin stack. So that's probably been the best one, frankly.
I guess the last one is what controversial opinion do you have that goes against conventional wisdom?
Controversial opinion that goes against conventional wisdom. I would say my Bitcoin premise. Like I don't think in real estate Twitter, most people in real estate Twitter have a pretty dim view of Bitcoin. I think for most people that have done like a serious deep dive into really understanding it, like 10, 20 hours, there's, if you put that time into with an open mind to understand it, I don't think you're going to have like the cynical views that I see in real estate Twitter about it. I think there's a lot of people like that have seen, and it does piss you off. Like when you see people making a ton of money on buying Bitcoin at a low price and like you missed out on that, that is a, you know, whatever. We all have greed and envy and jealousy. And so that's one that I just would say is somewhat controversial is my strong belief and high conviction in Bitcoin.
Yeah. I'd agree. Real estate Twitter is a wealth of knowledge, but they can be mean on there sometimes as well.
Oh,
maybe
yeah.
That's just Twitter in general.
That's Twitter in general, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're getting to the end here, Patrick, but obviously want to thank you so much for having us on your show to interview you. It's definitely been very insightful and I've learned a lot about you and more about real estate in general, but I did want to see if you had any kind of last words, final thoughts, words of encouragement for our listeners, primarily those that are early on in their investing career. So any words of advice before we get out of here?
Yeah. So first off, Nick and Dan, I really appreciate you having me on, asking the questions or having, you know, doing this together, organizing this. This has been a lot of fun and I appreciate your time as well. So, but in terms of like, whatever, something I would say to guys early in their career, and I actually love talking to guys that are early and interested and hungry about real estate. I would say just like, you've got to become a perpetual learner. You've got to be like continually learning, and you know, there's absolutely no excuse not to like really become an expert in whatever you choose to. And you've just got to put the time in. You've got to listen to the podcasts. You got to find the right people. You got to do the reading. You got to do the work. And then you can't stay in learning mode. I think too many people stay in learning mode. And I think I probably have been guilty of this off and on throughout my career where if I just get more knowledge and more information, then I'll be ready. It doesn't work that way. Like you just have to get in. You're never going to be 100% ready. You're going to learn more by doing your first deal than you will reading thousands of hours of books. Like you just have to get started. And that's what I would encourage anyone to do. Like real estate is an amazing opportunity. And like, there's always going to be opportunities. And like we said, you just find your niche and run with it. You're going to do well. If you've got the right, obviously you've got to work hard. You've got to be intelligent about it, but there's a lot of potential for a lot of young people to make a nice life for themselves through real estate.
Love it. Totally. Very well said. We're on your show, but the listeners, if they wanted to get in touch with you, where can they find you? What are your socials? How do people get in hold of you or work with you?
Yeah. So I'm on real estate Twitter, as we talked about a lot. So that's probably the best way. Like if you DM me, I'll definitely respond. Also through the Investors Podcast, you can reach out to me there. I've got my email, patrickdonnelly@theinvestorspodcast.com. I'll respond to anybody wants to reach out. I'm happy to talk, share what I can. So those are the two best ways is Twitter and by email. So thank you guys. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun and looking forward to this coming out.
Yeah. Thanks, Patrick.
Okay, folks, that's all I had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed the show and I'll see you back here real soon.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to subscribe to We Study Billionaires by the Investors Podcast Network. Every Wednesday, we teach you about Bitcoin, and every Saturday, we study billionaires and the financial markets. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.